I have John Devoy here, lads, live in the studio with me. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mick. Good to be here. Great to be in y'all.
And as Devil has said, go back, go do your travels and come back and tell the story. And that's exactly what you're doing, John.
Well, I took a time, Mick. It took 30 years to tell it. I don't think Dervla expected that, but anyway, the story, at least the beginning, part one of it is out there anyway, and Dervla, as anybody who has read the book, she's written the foreword, and actually over the years she really encouraged the writing of it. I think she knew there was an interesting story there to tell, you know.
What possessed you, John, to go and do it?
Well, that's like asking the guy why climb Everest, you know. I'm sure Pat Fallavy or any of these guys would give their own answers. Look, if the world is there, it's got to be explored. And some people have that gene. Some people don't. We're all different. Certainly growing up in Whitegate back in the early 60s, imagine an Irish village with dark-skinned guys walking through a village in 1961-62. I remember that when I was 4 or 5. And that sort of was the earliest, because I've been asked the question, obviously, before, and you do reflect and you say, well, you know, where did that spark come from at its earliest point? And that came to mind, looking at guys coming off the oil tankers, walking through the village to the pub or a cafe or someplace or a shop, and that really set something in that young 5-year-old's mind going, you know. And again, as the clip said there, my father going to Libya, that sparked it on again. Of course, then I was 10. And then you meet people as you go along, and some guys, I remember meeting a guy from Kerry who cycled in France when he was 20. So, you know, one thing gets layered on top of another, and then you say, well, why not? Go for it, you know.
And reading some of the book and reading, you know, little clips here and there, John, from the book, you met another guy that he decided he went one way, you went the other
way. Yes.
That's an amazing story, John. Who tell us about this guy.
When I moved to Cork as a 20-year-old, I shared a flat with a guy from Kilkenny who is still a good friend of mine, Eamon Wallace from Callan, County Kilkenny. And Eamon now, I would describe him as cool as a cucumber. Right. In fact, he's an organic farmer like myself and will grow a lot of cucumbers. But he's really, really cool. And when I told him I wanted to cycle to Cape Town via North Cape in Norway, he said, sure. Yeah, I think I'll go on a trip as well. He says, you know, to Australia. So both of us, remember now, folks, this is before communication technology. So we decided, or he decided to cycle to Australia and I decided to cycle to South Africa. But our paths crossed in Athens. So we met and we had a couple of weeks cycling on and off. And he went east and I went south.
And the amazing thing about that, John, is that he made an appointment at a certain time and a certain date.
That's right.
Did you keep that date?
Oh, we did. Yes.
He actually made it, did he?
Well, like, it's hard for people, especially young people today, to fathom this. But like, we said our farewell in Dublin. And I was gone then. But we had a rendezvous 6 months later. So there was no communication. We agreed we'd meet in a cafe in the centre of Athens 6 months at 5 o'clock in the evening, 6 months later. That was it.
And you did meet her?
Oh, we did, yeah, because I had the date and I remember cycling down through, if people remember, Yugoslavia.
Yes.
That'd be Serbia, Croatia, those countries that are there. Well, back then it was called Yugoslavia, and I remember thinking when I arrived in Yugoslavia, gee, Yugoslavia, or Serbia as it is now, is one big country. It's nearly 1,000 kilometres. And I was a couple of days, so I bombed down to get to Athens on the day. He arrived the day before on the 29th and I arrived on the day the 30th, about
6 months after.
6 months later. But that was the world.
To go back to the point you said there, John, and this struck me. There was no technology. There was no mobile phones.
No.
Nothing.
No.
Just a bike, saddle.
You were on your own. And as I said in the introduction of the book, I think, once you were rounded that corner, you were gone, right? I mean, you could have gone to some place to make a phone call, but mostly it was postcards and letters. And if I like asking young people, do they know what post-restant?
Isn't
and
it?
Usually you get a quizzical look, they don't know. But post-restant was where you receive your letters or your mail. You come into a place, show your passport in a post office and you get your mail, which was healthy. Those were the days. It was wonderful. As Dervla Murphy said, those were the days to travel, because traveling really means, for me, you know, it's a way of exploring not just the world, but you explore yourself, even though you don't intend to do that. But that's what happens on the road, because you're on your own. And often people today, they travel and they're Skyping each other, they're blogging, which is, I've nothing against technology. I have a phone in my pocket. But when you ask those people, what do they really want to get out of travel? They'll tell you, yeah, I want to explore myself, the world. I want to see what I'm made of. How do I deal with challenges? And I've said to one guy in particular, he's in my mind now, look, when you're in, you know, Pakistan, and when the SH hits the fan, as they say, you know, what are you going to do? You're telling me you want to test yourself, but you'll Skype your girlfriend or you'll talk to your mother. So back then there was no way, like, you know, you had to meet everything inside your own head, inside your own mind, and deal with it, you know. So
I did laugh at a piece of the book where we'll go through the actual journey in a second, but
sure, yeah.
That famous sharp pants you had.
Oh, the famous sharp pants.
My God.
I was going to bring it into studio, actually. It's out in the car. Yeah, the famous sharp pants, yes.
It was incredible. And you actually got it repaired.
Or patched. I think if somebody wants to see it, Mick is actually describing a pair of cycling shorts, which, I mean, you know, money was tight.
Yeah.
So I suppose these days you go in and you buy a new one. Back then it was just get patch after patch. And there was a patch done in Turkey. There was a patch done in Syria. There was a patch done in Egypt. There was a patch done in South Sudan. And I did do refer to the biggest patch of all was done in a town in the Congo.
I'm just trying to give the listeners a feeling of what it was like, John. You know, this wasn't comfort. This wasn't a comfort zone. This was
hard,
rock bottom.
Hardcore.
You know. Can I ask you, John, Dervla Murphy, what kind of an influence had she on you before you left? Was she a good guide here?
She, well, look, Mick, I put it this way. We travel in our era, right? So Dervla would have travelled in the early 60s. People would remember that.
Remind listeners what Dervla did.
Dervla Murphy lives not too far away, down in Lismore. She's still there. She's going on 89 now, I think, born in 1931. She cycled from Lismore to New Delhi in 1963.
My God.
So bear in mind, that was a hard winter in 1963. I remember that because I was 6 years of age and the snow was 6 inches deep in Whitegate. Right.
My goodness.
Unfortunately for her, that was the winter she decided to head off, and she headed off, and she had to dress as a man going through places like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and I think she had a gun at some point as well. But she's a tough lady, and that was the beginning of her journey. And anybody who reads books would know Dervla Murphy. Yeah. She's kept going, you know. But had she an influence on me? Of course she had. Yeah, I mean, I sent her a postcard. Pity I didn't bring in her response, but I have a card that she sent back just saying, look, I'm Sarah Jo Soap. You know, you don't know me, but I'm heading off on a 2-year cycle. And of course, I get a postcard back from Lismore saying, oh, come on down between such and such a time and on a certain date. And I did. And we've been in contact since. So she's been a huge influence on me, yeah, absolutely.
John, I'm looking at the map here, but just explain to the listeners the actual journey you did. You started in the header. You actually came through Yale, as far as I
know. Well, Mick, before we went on air, I did say to you that Yale has a sort of a special place for me because, yeah, I left on Fool's Day. I left the Hadda on
the 1st of
April. A
lot of people probably thought you were a fool to be here.
They did. That's why I deliberately chose Fool's Day to leave, because a lot of people thought this guy's off the wall. You
right,
know?
Right.
In fact, I remember one guy saying, well, he's not going to get past a certain pub in Rostellan, you know. So he'll probably stop there now and spend 6 months in the pub and come back with some sort of a story, you know. But no, I actually took took the back roads out of Ahada and came through Cloyne.
Right.
And came down here to Youghal. And the story I was telling you, which is true, and I've told your colleagues, coming through Youghal, it was the first and last time I've cycled through Youghal. I was coming, approaching the clock tower. Now, I had driven through, but when you approach it on a bicycle, you're coming at the clock tower slower.
Yeah.
And I was looking up, noticing it for the first time, but didn't notice an elderly woman who was just ahead on the footpath. And because back then in 1985, fewer cars on the road, I was on a bicycle, she heard nothing. She stepped off. I was looking at the top of the tower, bang, knocked this elderly lady with her shopping bag onto the ground.
I wonder if she's listening.
It was a while ago, so if she's alive, my apologies now publicly on the Youghal Community Radio. I'm very, very sorry.
We're going to trace this woman.
Anyway, we have to. I'm sure she's long forgotten it, but if she's there, yeah, I'm sorry about that. But I do remember Youghal coming through, and then I clipped off to Lismore, and I remember cycling through Lismore and passing, I don't know if people might know where Dervla Murphy lives, in the centre of Lismore. I just remember passing and sort of waving in a way to where she lives, that gateway down the little alleyway where Dervla lives, and then heading on with the journey, you know. But the journey took me through the UK, to Holland, through Germany, northern Germany, Hamburg, up to the tip of Denmark, a ferry across to Oslo, up the west coast of Norway, which is one long cycle, I can guarantee you. Norway's a long country, up to North Cape. And the idea was to get to North Cape, which is as far up in Europe as you can go, Mick.
Yeah.
And the reason North Cape was, that's where on the 21st of June, the sun doesn't set. It's the summer.
My goodness.
Midnight sun. So that's as far up as you can go. So the plan was to get up to North Cape for the 21st of June. So I left Ahada on the 1st of April, and I got to North Cape on the 20th of June. And of course, it was cloudy, so I didn't see the sun, but I didn't care because that was only the beginning of the journey. So I spent, you could say, that a couple of thousand kilometres of a warm-up to get to the starting line, because in my mind, getting to North Cape was the starting point.
Yeah.
And then I turned around as far up in Europe as you can go, and I tried, honestly, I tried to imagine arriving at Cape Point, South Africa, and it was just too big an idea to hold. But that was the beginning then, through Finland, through Poland, back to Germany, through countries that are gone now, like Czechoslovakia, Austria, Hungary, as I said earlier, Yugoslavia, down to Greece to meet my friend Eamon, who's still going strong in Callan. We're still good buddies. And then back up through Bulgaria, across Turkey and into Syria, which was an incredible journey with the hospitality of Syrians. And it's sad to hear about Syria today. Yeah. Down into Lebanon, across the Sinai Peninsula. And I arrived in Cairo for Christmas. So Quandam, Mick, as you've dipped into it, it's an unusual book because it doesn't start in Ahada. It starts in Cairo. So I'm dropping the reader straight into the heat of battle. I'm dropping them in. I'll come back to the Ahada and the Youghal bit in a second book, but I just wanted to throw the reader straight into the heat of battle, you could say.
33,000 kilometres.
33,000, probably a bit
on
more.
On a push bike?
Oh, on two wheels. Yeah, two wheels.
That's incredible for a long journey. Just briefly, any the dangers that you faced. I mean, you wouldn't do it now, John, would you?
Oh, you would.
Would you?
I mean, you of course, and there's lots of guys doing it. Mick, I describe in the book, they're nearly queuing up to go through Africa and around the world. It's look, there's thousands, as we speak here now, there's probably thousands of girls and guys out there on bikes. The big difference is it's completely different. I would describe it as, and I'll probably be shot down for saying this now, because, you know, if you cycle down to Cape Town today, it's a great achievement.
It certainly would be, John.
But it is sterile in the sense that there's a nice flat, smooth tarmac road,
whatever, yeah. Right?
Whereas back then you literally had to drag a bike through sands. There were no roads. There was no communication. The experience was chalk and cheese, really, you know.
Some of the things you encounter, John, the poverty in places, I suppose, you can see that when you're on a bicycle, not in a car or a bus or a train, but in a bike, you probably can see that more than anyone, can you?
You see everything on a bike. You see the bees and the butterflies and the birds and the farms and the growing of crops and the people at the edge of the road. And as you go through countries, you see intimately, really, what's happening. And, of course, that affects you as well, awesome. Because there's no whizzing by. You stop and you're welcomed. You're given lots of cups of tea and meals, and every country is different in that regard. But yeah, you're up close and personal.
Well, John, during your travels, unfortunately, you got some devastating news from home about your dad.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
Tell us what that was and how you dealt with it.
Well, he died beginning of March.
Your dad?
Yeah. So I was in Sudan, I was in Khartoum when he died, but obviously, you know, how was I to know?
Yeah.
So I would have gone on to Darfur, which is in Western Sudan, and then came back. And because of the civil war in the south of Sudan, I had to fly into Juba, which is the capital of South Sudan now, and then make my way into the Congo.
Right.
I was ill with hepatitis, and then pretty soon after had cerebral malaria, so I had my own problems. Anyway,
yeah.
And was on death's door really with the cerebral malaria, but got through that with the help of the medical missionaries of Mary, Irish nuns and doctors who were working in Uganda, and got through and got to Nairobi. And in the Irish embassy in Nairobi, I was handed two telegrams, one that my father had died, but when I looked at the date, he was already dead and buried 2 months.
My God.
So that was the sort of the time that was. How I dealt with it, well, hard to describe really. You know, you go to, as I described in the book, you go to a park, you read the telegram, the Irish embassy were fantastic because they gave use of a phone. So you phoned home. I spoke to brothers and family and friends and that. But, you know, there was nothing you could do.
No,
you know.
No.
You just. I went on to Madagascar, which I hadn't planned on going to. So I went to Madagascar, I suppose, to debrief and get my head around that news, and that sort of turned the trip around because I was quite close to coming back at that point.
Yeah, I mean, when you have an adventure in front of you and you really are going well, and something like this hits you and knocks you back, it's very hard to see envision for the following couple of days, weeks, or whatever. You know, knowing what happened back home. But it was a mighty achievement to go continue and finish it, John, because as you said, there was nothing you could do if you came home.
Well, my brother put it fairly bluntly, Mickey, right?
Right.
And he said, when I was talking to him on the phone in the embassy, he said, why come back? He says, you know, are you going to stand by Dad's grave and just say a prayer? And what do you do then, like?
Yeah.
So that was the wake up call, really. You know, I sort of grieved him in Madagascar, and then got on with it because I think he, having done a little bit of travelling himself, that's exactly what he would have wanted me to do anyway, you know.
Right.
So in a way, he was sort of speaking from beyond the grave, saying, "Look, lad, get going."
John, we were going to stop for a bit of music, but unfortunately, we're not, because it's 28 minutes past 9 already. I want you to read a paragraph, dear John.
You're going
to read a paragraph. By the way, John de Voylet comes from a very well-known footballing family down in Ahada. I can tell you that.
I think we played against each other, or with each other.
With each other, we did in 76, I think, or 75. John, just before you go to read a paragraph, when did you decide to move from Ahada to Roscarbery?
Well, I came back, I was working in...
Sorry, listeners, John is running a very successful... I think you have it leased out now, have you?
I have it leased out, yeah. But I did it for 20 years.
A hill farm, more or less.
An organic farm. In horticulture, and we had...
Right. When did you decide, John, to move?
I came back, Mick, and I was living in Cork City. I was working in the biochemistry department. But I suppose it's important to say here, when you come back from 2 years living out of a pot and out of a tent, you ain't the same.
No.
The world has changed.
Very hard to adjust, has it changed?
It's very, very hard to adjust. In fact, I would describe that the real trip only began when I came back. So I was working in the laboratory, and after a pretty short time realised that, no, this isn't going to do me for the rest of my life, and I wanted a bigger challenge. And that, I think if anybody has watched the Nationwide thing, they cover that pretty well.
Yeah, they do.
So I decided to hitch up the wagon and ride down to West Cork, and we found a couple of acres down there, and we as in my wife and I, started an organic farm.
When did you get married, John Bennett?
1994. Yeah.
That was a good few years after you came back. So.
Always was, yeah. No, Sarah has nothing to do with that, with that previous life whatsoever.
So, and a couple of lovely kids, I see them.
We have three great kids, Oisin, Aisha and Mariel. They're great and
brilliant.
They're all out in the world now, you know.
So the farm, John, you adapted well to the outdoor lives, as the fella said.
I needed to sort of roll up the sleeves. Working in the laboratory or working in an office wouldn't have done me after that trip. I needed to sort of get stuck into something, even though I don't have a pedigree or lineage in farming at all. But you know, if you want to do something, and I'd say this to anybody, if you want to do something, roll up your sleeves, find out, ask people, and you do, no matter what it is, you know.
Yeah.
So I just threw myself into a farm, and we made a success of it. And now I'm at the stage I'm at now. I've leased it to a younger blood, and I'm getting on with writing.
Good. Now, John, what we're going to do is we're going to leave it read, because we are going over time. But you read a paragraph, John, of the book, and then we'll tidy up.
Wrap up. Okay, mate.
All right, John.
Pleasure.
So I'll hand it to John de Voiles, and he'll read a paragraph from this book, Quantum. By the way, the print, John, there's another print coming out, so hopefully...
Oh, the book is available in Crees here in Yall, or it's available... Might I add, Mick, there's a big night happening in the book centre in Waterford.
Okay.
That's on February the 7th, Friday, I think, February the 7th at 6:30 in the book centre in Waterford. And that's interesting because it's important to say it's the first time in Ireland that a Polish guy... younger than me, but he's also travelled a little bit in Africa, and he's written a book in Polish.
Okay.
So a Polish lady living in Waterford has single-handedly organised this with the book centre, that lovely bookshop in Waterford City, where the two of us, Paul and I, will read from our books.
Brilliant.
And talk about our respective journeys. So just keep that in mind, book centre in Waterford on February the 7th at 6:30.
Okay, John, and if you want to go in, listeners, into... John DeVoy Arts, or even you can get pieces out. I've gone back and listened to John Deere.
The website John DeVoy Author is easy, and the book is available anywhere, any bookshop will get it.
Okay, John.
Well, I'll start off.
Ahead. Yeah.
Mick, And I'm going to read from just the first paragraph from chapter one, right? So the opening part of the book. Yeah. Chapter one. The Nile is Egypt. Egypt is the Nile. On the top floor of the Oxford Hotel, the window I wanted to open just wouldn't. Layers of old paint had sealed it. But then, with one final sharp pull, the chill air suddenly rushed in, and I stuck my head out into the last day of the year. Dusk was sweeping fast over Cairo. Down below, on Talat Harb Street, the business of the day was almost done, and bar some traffic and the occasional honk of a taxi, the street was emptying itself. The city's foot soldiers, Egypt's urban fellaheen, were drifting home. Across the street, in another window, one floor lower, a small plastic Christmas tree blinked its white lights in an otherwise darkened building. Off on, off on, off on. A lone token to Christian tradition, but enough to make me think of home. Until the umpteen minarets called out to prayer and a Quranic rhythm wafted over us all.
John, well done. Well done, John.
Thank you, Mick.
I haven't read the book, obviously, yet, John, but I have looked at bits and pieces. And I just can't wait. But I will not read a bit today and put it away. I'm going to read this right through.
Take your time.
Yeah. I'm going to read it right through, because I think if you don't, you'll lose the whole impetus going into the book. I prefer to start, read it night after night, and finish it tonight. That's the way I feel about the book, the pieces I've written.
Yes.
But John, yes. It's been a wonderful, wonderful.
Thanks, Mick. Good to be here.
To go around 33,000 in 2 years, 33,000 kilometres. An incredible feat, John.
Yeah. Yes. I might do it again.
An incredible feat. John, look here. Listen, I want to thank you sincerely for coming in because it only for Jimmy mentioning it to me. And I said, should I know the device? Because you come from a well-known GA family.
Yes,
so
that's
right. I know the lads down there. And I didn't realise, John, I haven't met you with probably 40 years, it's close than 40 years.
Anyway. I'd say 1976, Mick,
around
I'd say.
Around that. Yeah. So close 34, 35 years. And to meet guys, I like, there was a Michael Heafy down in Whitegate, for instance. He was in the class of my big tile lad going to school. There's just lads like that that I went to school with back then that I would love to meet again.
That's right.
But like you, John, the things you learn from lads that have, you think that I don't know, working in a farm or working in an office or something, until you realise what they have achieved in life. And this is certainly, have you other books as well, John?
Well, this is Quandam Travels in a Once World, Mick, is the first of three.
Okay.
So as I say, this one drops you into Cairo and brings you down to Nairobi, but it's not a normal travel book, as anybody who has read it will tell you. There's a bit more meat on the bone. The second book brings you on to through the rest of Africa, Madagascar, all the way down to Cape Town, and there's some interesting points. You think you're going on a geographical journey, but you're not. There's a couple of other a lot more meat in the sandwich.
Right. I remember you came back when, John? Or sorry, go back, carry on to the third book?
No, the third book sort of wraps it up, Mick. It's unusual because I'm sort of making a big... The third book brings you right back to how it began.
Okay, yeah.
So the third book brings you back to, you know, I had a...
Right.
Maybe that incident in Yaw that we mentioned.
Right.
And brings you on then to an organic farm and how the whole thing ended, you know.
Brilliant.
So there are three books and I'm working on the second one at the moment. So
Brilliant. We're going to give away one of the books, lads, in the Breakfast Show this morning, and Noel Cronin's programme follows, so we'll give away, and John, you might sign the book
for us.
I will
sign it, absolutely.
One last question I have for you, and I noticed it when I was reading about it. You finished that cycle win in
1987.
So that is 33 years ago.
That's right.
The interesting thing was that it took you all those years before you wrote the book, but you felt that you needed that time to really assess the whole situation.
Yeah, this book could never have been written by that young lad.
Okay.
Let's be very clear
about
that.
From the 80s.
No, this book could never,
That's
ever
what
have
really
been written.
Because
the sad thing is there's a lot of travel books out there, Mick, and they're written too fast, too soon by young lads who've done great trips.
Right.
I mean, let's not dispute that. But it takes time, as we know at our age, to understand what you did back then.
Yeah.
So if I'd written a book back then, it would have been just another superficial, been there, done that type of telling you a story. Whereas Quandam, I'm a little bit older, maybe slightly a bit wiser than I was. So you understand a little more, so you can offer a bit more. And I'm so, so happy. And actually, Dervla Murphy herself said, you know, be glad that you took the time to write it. So it took
the time. Because I found that very interesting, how you waited some, because what really galls me is when you see fellas writing autobiographies at 23 years of age or 24.
I know, it really gets to me.
I don't mind to see the likes of Lester Piggott or these lads after all their years.
Right.
But when I see fellas at 22 or 23 writing an autobiography, I say, what in the name? You know.
They should write another one at 63.
No, you said it, John. John, listen, my sincere thanks for coming on this morning. John Devoy, lads. The Quandam is the name of the book. It's for sale in Cree's Card Shop. Or it will be, or it is, John?
Well, Cree's will get it, and the other bookshop in town as well.
Yeah, Read and Write.
Even the library, and I think the library might have me down to do, if I think they have a reader's group in the library.
They have, because we read it all.
So we're talking about that. But look, if Cree's are, forgive me, I've forgotten the other name of the bookshop.
Read and Write.
Yeah. They'll have it.
They'll have it as well.
Yeah. Or online, if people want to get it online, I would say go to books.ie.
Okay.
Or Kenny's in Galway, Kenny's.ie. They'll get books.ie or Kenny's in Galway. We'll get it if you want to buy it online. But
well done, Mick. Yeah, I'm just glad. Well done, Mick, here, just noting that 9:30 is just in. A text in. Well done, Mick. A class interview, John. Well done indeed, John. Well
Thank
done.
You.
It's a great reception from the listeners. So, John, we wish you the best of luck. You won't try it again, hopefully.
I might.
I wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me. Jan Devoy, listeners, author of the book Quandam, Travels in a Once World. Wonderful book, Jan.
Thank you,
I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.